Welcome to the Benefits Executive Roundtable, hosted by Dorothy Koshu, President of Advanced Benefit Consulting. Dorothy is a nationally recognized benefits and compliance consultant and group health broker. Here, you'll listen to industry experts break down the latest news and trends in employee benefits, healthcare reform, regulations and compliance, all designed to empower executive decisions.
Welcome to the Benefits Executive Roundtable. I'm your host, Dorothy Koshu, President of Advanced Benefit Consulting, and I'd like to welcome my guests today, Marilyn Monahan of Monahan Law Office, Ted Flitner and Ted Miyashiba of Aditi Group, our IT, cybersecurity, and technology partners. This is part one of a two-part special podcast event during Cybersecurity Awareness Month. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you, Dorothy. I'm happy to be here today with you and Ted to talk about the relationship between ERISA and cybersecurity.
And it's always great to be back with all of you here to talk about our favorite thing, which is security, cybersecurity.
Thanks, Ted. And that was Ted Flitner, by the way, so that you can identify his voice.
Yes, thank you, Dorothy. This is Ted Miyashiba. Thanks for inviting us on to delve in further into this important issue.
Well, I really appreciate you all being here. We have a huge topic today, as you guys know, a panel discussion on the U.S. Department of Labor and EBSA cybersecurity guidance and what it means to plan sponsor employers and plan fiduciaries. Basically, I'm getting the band back together for this because we all did a webinar on this topic for ABC in June. So thanks so much for coming back for yet another round of cybersecurity talk. Marilyn and I discussed the ERISA fiduciary risks in episode two this season, so this will be somewhat of a continuation of that discussion. Marilyn, let's start with you. The Government Accountability Office issued a report on retirement plans and cybersecurity in 2021 and made two recommendations for the Department of Labor. Can you tell us about those recommendations as well as the DOL's prior discussions of taking appropriate precautions to mitigate risks of malfeasance to benefit plans, quote unquote, cyber or otherwise, and they're stating that this was a fiduciary function?
I'd be happy to. In some respects, this all started with a report issued by the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, in 2021, having to do with retirement plans and cybersecurity specifically. And in that report, the GAO made two recommendations to the Department of Labor. First, they recommended that the DOL should formally state whether cybersecurity is a fiduciary responsibility for retirement plans. And the Department of Labor responded to that by issuing the three guidance documents we're going to talk about a little bit more later today. The second recommendation was that the Department of Labor should identify a minimum set of expectations for mitigating cybersecurity risks, for example, by adopting NIST standards. So far, the Department of Labor has not directly responded to that second recommendation. Now then, in follow-up or in connection with that, the DOL has stated in various contexts, in addition to its discussions with the GAO, that taking appropriate precautions to mitigate risks of malfeasance to their plans, cyber or otherwise, is a fiduciary function under both the duties of loyalty and prudence. And that includes adding cybersecurity considerations when selecting service providers. The DOL has stated that under ERISA, reasonable plan fiduciaries have an obligation to ensure proper mitigation of cybersecurity risks. The DOL has also noted in this context that the ERISA record retention rules require that electronic record keeping systems must have reasonable controls, records must be maintained in a safe and accessible manner, and confidentiality must be protected. So we've got the fiduciary functions that are brought in, and we've got the record retention rules, which are also a part of this analysis.
Well, in 2021, the Department of Labor told the GAO that ERISA is meant to be broad and apply to a wide range of activity, and that they expect plan administrators to keep their IT systems secure as part of their fiduciary responsibility, as you just mentioned. But as of 2021, the GAO reported that no court decisions had addressed the application of ERISA to cybersecurity practices. And the DOL also reported to the GAO that it's undertaken both civil and criminal investigations of cybersecurity incidents after receiving complaints from participants, from service providers, from state regulators, and law enforcement. And that all changed in 2022, Marilyn, with Walsh versus All Right Solutions. Can you tell us about this and why it's so important?
Yes. So following an incident in which a hacker was able to steal a lot of money out of our participant's retirement account, two things occurred. The participant sued and the DOL started investigating the TPA. As a result of the TPA investigation, we now have a Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals decision confirming that the reasonableness of a plan's cybersecurity services and the extent of any breaches is relevant to determining if a breach of fiduciary duty has occurred. So now we know that the DOL takes the position that plan fiduciaries must implement cybersecurity programs. We know that they have stated that they have instituted both civil and criminal investigations when they feel that proper cybersecurity practices have not been followed. And we now know that the courts have backed up the DOL and said, yes, having good cybersecurity practices is part of a plan's fiduciary responsibilities. With all of these developments and feedback, we now know that plan fiduciaries are on notice that they should turn their attention to cybersecurity if they have not already done so.
Yeah, that's really important, as you and I have been talking about for quite some time. So in 2021, the Department of Labor issued guidance on cybersecurity requirements. Why did they do that, Marilyn, and why is there a need for this? Can you tell us briefly about the three sets of guidances that were released?
The guidance was issued in response to the GAO report, as we understand it, to emphasize, as the GAO recommended, that cybersecurity compliance or cybersecurity protections are part of a plan's fiduciary obligations. They actually issued three separate documents, and each one is directed at a critical aspect of cybersecurity planning, as I'm sure Ted and Ted will break down in more detail later on. So the three documents are, first, cybersecurity best practices, and that's designed to assist plan fiduciaries, record keepers, and service providers in their responsibilities to manage cybersecurity risks. The second document is tips for hiring a service provider to help plan sponsors and fiduciaries prudently select a service provider with strong cybersecurity practices and monitor their activities on an ongoing basis as ERISA requires. And the third prong to this was the third document, online security tips, which is actually directed at participants, and it offers participants and beneficiaries who check their accounts online basic rules to reduce the risk of fraud and loss.
Well, thanks, Marilyn. And I'm going to ask you this, and then I'll ask for Ted and Ted's input as well. Why does cybersecurity compliance matter?
Well, as we've just talked about, it's the legal standard. It's part of the legal standard under ERISA, both under the fiduciary rules as well as the record retention rules. So it's an obligation. And if you don't meet that obligation, you could be subject to a DOL investigation or a breach of fiduciary duty claim.
Well, I think what Marilyn has spoken about very eloquently in other terms is that this is a supply chain issue. If you think of your software, of your service, of what you do, it used to be that cybersecurity only applied to you individually as an island. Now, DOL and the legal definitions have come forward, and that whole term of fiduciary duty really comes back to an example that came home to a lot of people during the pandemic, which was you go to Target and you look for toilet paper and there's nothing on the shelf. And we all understand that that was a supply chain issue. It started with the manufacturers, the distributors, and the like. Similarly, your employees look to you as the employer, as the one who has the fiduciary duty to protect their privacy and all their information. And what the DOL has basically said is, yes, you have that responsibility, and it goes back up the chain, not only to you, employer, but to whomever you contract with as a partner to deal with that data. And that's where this becomes an issue for true cybersecurity compliance, not only for you, but you have a responsibility to take action and be responsible for the people that you go and contract to deal with that data.
Yeah, so this is really about legal compliance, and it's on the other side, it's about doing the right thing. The right thing by your employees, the right thing by, you know, whatever their is going on with their current programs and your employees' retirement programs. You know, because remember this all started with that spark when the GAO, you know, sent out the report, and that was, you know, sparked by and actually that first lawsuit that Marilyn mentioned, that was sparked by, you know, somebody's retirement account being pilfered. You know, so it's really about doing the right thing from the company corporate perspective on behalf of your employees. And as Ted mentioned, it's you know, it touches all the different areas. And really this is, I think all of us are kind of in the same mindset here that, you know, the DOL is a little bit late to the party because we've been dealing with this kind of thing with HIPAA for decades. But what they're doing now, they've just kind of put out this first floor, initial floor of security practices that should be followed. It's really about doing the right thing.
Yeah, and they might be late to the party, but I'd rather that they be late to the party than not be at the party at all. So I'm really actually glad that they put out these three sets of guidances because we really did need them.
Everything that Ted and Ted both said is very critical, very important. I agree with it all. And I would also emphasize doing the right thing because it's not only I've been emphasizing the legal requirements, but you also want to consider the confidence you're giving your employees in the safety of their data. They're turning over a lot of data to you, a lot of information, and they want to make sure that it's kept protected. And so that's an important aspect of an employer's function as an employer, as a plan sponsor of an employee welfare benefit plan or retirement plan. You want to make sure you're building confidence in your workforce so that they know when they turn this data over to you, or in the retirement plan context, they turn their money over to you, that it's well protected and secure.
And I guess that brings up a question that you and I get asked a lot. And so I'm just going to ask you, I know you kind of briefly stated just a second ago, but as I said, we get this question all the time. So I just wanted to put it out there. Does this just apply to pension plans, or does the guidance also apply to health and welfare plans?
It applies to both. The guidance issued by the DOL does focus on retirement plans because the GAO report focused on retirement plans, but it applies to both pension as well as health and welfare benefit plans. And the reason for that is the responsibility emanates from your fiduciary obligations as well as the record retention rules, and those apply equally to all types of plans administered by the Department of Labor.
Well, thank you for that. Let's start with the DOL's requirement and their tips for hiring service providers with strong cybersecurity practices. Business owners, plan sponsor employers, they have a fiduciary responsibility under ERISA to prudently select and monitor their service providers. So what's included in this guidance?
The guidance is rather detailed, and the things that I will emphasize is include cybersecurity in your RFP process if you're going through that, or as you're interviewing potential service providers. You want to ask them about their cybersecurity practices. You want to get in writing their promises as to what it is they will do in order to ensure that data is kept secure. And you want to be able to, if you do hire them, to be able to monitor that on an ongoing basis so that you can, if necessary, go in and audit them periodically to make certain that they're living up to the promises they've made to you. And that then reaches into after the RFP process and you hire them, you want to make certain that their obligation to provide good cybersecurity protections is written into the service provider agreement. So read those clauses, in addition to all the other clauses in the written contract, carefully to make certain that both sides understand what the responsibilities are and both sides can be held accountable for coordinating good cybersecurity practices going forward.
From the cybersecurity side, much of what's included in the guidance mirrors really good practice for the purchase of any services. In this case, however, you're being asked to partner with a company that together ensures security, your PII, the information, your private data, and continued services for your employees and extension your company. You know, of course, price is a consideration, but certainly not the primary consideration. Security, reliability, service responsiveness to any attacks on your services are important. The team, and I emphasize team because you and the service provider are a team, has to react as a unit to minimize damage. Dorothy, I think the checklist you provide is a good start.
Well, thanks for that. And yeah, we do actually have a checklist that we created at ABC. I created that with the assistance, of course, from Ted and Ted to make sure that we captured all of the items that they're asking for in the guidances so that you can basically document them. We'll come back to this and we'll discuss this quite a bit. But thanks for that comment, Ted. It's really important that you understand when you're hiring service providers and even when you're monitoring your current service providers and you're taking a look at these, that you have some sort of documentation in place, which I'm sure Marilyn will talk about again, says why you selected that service provider and to make sure for yourself that when you hire that service provider, that they're going to do a good job for you and that you compared and contrasted with potentially other service providers. So all of those things come into play, and those are all fiduciary responsibilities under ERISA that are covered in the cybersecurity guidance, which I thought was quite interesting.
Dorothy, I want to emphasize exactly what you said about getting it in writing. In the Walsh case, in the underlying lawsuit brought by the participant, one of the issues was whether or not the employer did their due diligence in hiring the TPA. So if you could, you need to document that process so that you can show that even if a breach occurs later on, hopefully it won't, but if it does, that you can establish that you took all the steps possible in order to make the best choice of the best TPA for your plan.
Right. And Marilyn, to that point, yes, documentation is everything, as we will cover later in this podcast. And it's important that that who is responsible for what if a breach occurs is absolutely critical. And like I said, we'll cover that.
Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah. And I want to emphasize also that this is the DOL's, you know, really first volley into this, you know, as I mentioned, you know, kind of late coming to the party. And there are only three documents, you know, two of these are two pages. One of them is a 5-page document. So these are brief, but they're very, very broad, very, very umbrella encompassing. As we're mentioning, you know, it covers the due diligence for selecting the plan, the quality assurance, if you will, for managing and maintaining the relationship with the plan, ensuring that the plan is, you know, performing as it should from, you know, all these different security perspectives and so on, and all the record keeping. So these are, you know, really the first documents that the DOL's put out, the first rules, if you will. And they cover a whole lot of territory.
Yeah. For how short they were, they really do cover a lot of territory. So that's why, as Ted mentioned and I mentioned a moment ago, that we think it's really important that you document and put everything in a checklist or a questionnaire or something like that so that people can respond to those so that you get responses from everyone on all your service providers and when you're comparing and contrasting. I created a questionnaire which turns into a checklist and also a chart that you can monitor service provider by service provider and so you can compare them and put a ranking system in. And I think that the way this guidance is out there, what they're trying to tell you to do, they don't exactly tell you exactly that you have to do that, but in reading between the lines and in reading what they're saying you need to accomplish, I don't know how you would accomplish that without doing something just like that, having a questionnaire, having a checklist, having a chart, something like that to compare the service providers. Would you agree with that, Marilyn?
Yes, I think that's the most effective and efficient way to go about it. So I think a checklist along those lines is an absolutely essential tool. It's efficient, it's effective. It also is a wonderful way to help synthesize your decision-making process and shows the steps that you took as well as the justification for your final decision.
Yeah, and I agree with that wholeheartedly. Well, for all of us, let's talk about the service provider monitoring process. This process should include figuring out what categories you're monitoring, how often you're going to monitor them, and who is assigned to monitoring. So let's talk about this. Marilyn, what can you tell us about monitoring?
Well, I'm going to defer to Ted and Ted on the actual steps you should take in the monitoring process. But the two points that I'm going to emphasize is, you know, have a point person who is responsible for keeping track of these items, and then also a point person who may or may not be the same person who's responsible for overseeing the monitoring process. And that should be someone with some understanding of cybersecurity. But before you even get there, I'm going to go back to my comments earlier about having a good service provider agreement, because you want to have written down an understanding and an obligation on the service provider's part that they will allow you to participate in this monitoring process, that they will allow you to go in and audit them X number of times per year to make certain that they are in full compliance. And then if any problems are uncovered, either as a result of a breach or just in the monitoring process, that there's a mechanism for fixing those to the plan's satisfaction.
Yeah, communication is the hallmark of any good team. I brought that up earlier, that you are a team with your service provider or providers. Attacks are becoming more sophisticated every day. With artificial intelligence, more effective attacks are being unleashed. Zero-day attacks, which are things that we've never seen before, are becoming commonplace. So a review of the changing landscape with your partner is critical to maintaining cybersecurity in your system. And I think having that outlined is important.
Yeah, so these are very similar to quality assurance and quality control practices that might be in place for the manufacturing of a product or manufacturing of food or other kinds of things where you're producing something on a regular basis. You want to be able to go and audit your supply partners, and you also want to have reporting from them on the attributes that you think are important. In this case, the attributes that are important are, how do they manage your data? How do they manage the data of your employees? Do they have various different security protocols and protections in place? Do they have data backup? Do they have robust testing of their security, basically the risk surface? Do they have good security practices for their employees? Do they monitor record activity? Are they looking for trouble, or are they just going to wait until trouble shows up? So there's a lot of things that you're looking for in terms of what practices they do. And then for some of those things, there's going to be some data. There's going to be kind of like, here's what we found each week, some reporting data that can come out that you can be looking at.
In addition to that, in that Walsh All Light Solutions that Marilyn had mentioned at the top of this podcast, the root cause issue was really could have been avoided through some better training of their employees. One of the things that, as in your fiduciary duty, is to figure out, so of the people that you subcontracted to do to be the customer facing part, talking to your employees, are they trained properly to ask the right questions in the right ways? And to just listen to what the operator on the line talk to the bad person who was trying to steal the money, it was clear to me that they had not been trained properly. And I think that is a part of your fiduciary duty as an employer to make sure that the service provider is really taking this seriously.
Yeah, and one of the things we talked about in June at our webinar was, when you see inefficiencies and failures to perform, what are you doing about this? What is your process for reporting this to the service provider? What are you doing to make sure that this is resolved? And how do you get improvement on that particular item? Did you guys want to make some comments about that as well?
Well, that's critical. I mean, it's critical that you have a reporting process. And as Ted mentioned, communication is the most important thing here when you're teaming with somebody. And if you don't have two-way communication, then it doesn't work. So you have to have designated roles and responsibilities. You have to have designated communication channels and designated procedures. When something doesn't look right, you have to be able to report that back. You need a response back from your service partner, and you need it within a certain time frame. So all that needs to be kind of defined and understood in advance so that you're in agreement, you're on the same page.
So Ted and Ted, the guidance calls for a recognized standard of information security and outside monitoring. Can you tell our listeners what this means from the IT perspective and what should be included in this process?
The Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Alliance, or CISA, connects industry and government to share resources, analysis, and tools to help build cybersecurity resilience. That's the term that we're using now, because it's not a defense. In other words, it's not the Maginot line. it is assumed that the 1 in 100, 1 in 1,000 attacks will be successful. So what will you do about it? Well, one is, how do you know that the attacker has made it in? And two, how are you going to respond to that? So that's the environment that we're in. So from the IT perspective, there's four broad action categories that we recommend. Reduce the likelihood of a damaging intrusion. Two, take steps to quickly detect a potential intrusion. Three, ensure that the organization is prepared to respond if an intrusion occurs. And four, maximize the organization's resilience to a destructive cyber incident. Basically, that was known as business continuity. So we'll get into much more details as we go forward in this podcast. But in a broad brush, there seems to be agreement between the government and industry that those are the four things that we should be looking at as a framework for cybersecurity compliance.
That really, you know, it starts with a framework, right? The information that is going to be required for each individual situation is going to differ, you know, and, you know, the infrastructure is different. Things are unique in every situation. So it's really what's that, you know, kind of general, you know, points of framework. And we're always going to start with risk analysis. That was the first thing in there. And then, you know, the last thing in there is really looking at resilience, maximizing resilience, which is, as Ted mentioned, business continuity. That's what we normally refer to that. You know, so it's really that framework. The details are going to be dependent on the situation. A good fiduciary role in choosing the right partner to begin with. And as Ted mentioned in the GAO case, or excuse me, in the Walsh case, that was a service partner that really was not trained. At least some of their staff was not properly trained, and the staff allowed a hacker to basically social engineer their way into someone's account. You know, so this whole idea of you have a fiduciary responsibility to pick the right partners, that's where this is all anchored.
And really, as a partner in something that's serious, you have to take the stand that, you know, it's my company and we are subcontracting with you, and therefore we are a team. It's been tradition to this point to obtain and contract services as a transactional deal only, and you're going to provide service, and I don't care how you do it, you just provide service. Well, with the DOL's definition of fiduciary duty, their broad brush strokes, that's no longer the case. Really, it is a partnership. It's true supply chain management. And as those of us who were short toilet paper a couple of years ago know, that really it takes a lot of heavy lifting from a lot of different people to make sure that that doesn't happen again.
I would add to that, and related to that, is when you're looking for a new service provider, understand who's going to be on your team. It's not just the salespeople, it's the operations people. Can you build a good relationship with them? And what is the management structure like? Because if a problem does arise, you want them to, as Ted and Ted have talked about, be part of the team and communicate with you, not stonewall, but that you want them to, dig in and try to find the answers and try to find solutions so that you can move forward. I'll also add to this, in the case of us an ongoing service provider relationship, listen to your employees. If you're hearing from them that they're not satisfied with the level of service that they're getting, or that they've noticed issues, they thought maybe their identity should have been validated more thoroughly when they called up, whatever it may be, find out what they're saying. And if they're not happy, that's a red flag to you. Maybe even survey them in some cases to find out what their level of satisfaction is.
Yeah, and I just want to focus on, I just want to come back to my original question. I'd also mentioned past security breaches and how they're mitigated, and this goes right along with what you guys were saying. You know, it's really important, especially when you're looking at new vendors, you need to do some research on your own. You need to find out, have they ever had breaches that are on public platforms, such as the Department of Health and Human Services Wall of Shame, which is someplace that we don't want to be, of course. Can you do a Google search and find out if there are any newspaper articles or anything else about investigations, something like that? Those are all examples of things that you need to do as a fiduciary to make sure that you're doing your due diligence, adding on to what Marilyn, Ted, and Ted were saying, that are really easy for you to do in today's world. Google searches and looking at the Department of Health and Human Services website, you know, for their Wall of Shame and who had a breach and how many people did it affect. Those are all pretty easy things to do. And you can do that pretty quickly and efficiently with, you know, computers and all of the technology that we have today.
Dorothy, I have one other comment going back to the All White case. There is an existing track record for that particular service provider to be very lax in cybersecurity and in disclosure of PII. The issue, however, was that those people had been acquired by a larger company and then acquired by another larger company. And so it's tough sometimes to find that track record. But I think your purchasing people or whoever is doing your due diligence has to go back a few years and see what that track record is, because there were cases that the court dockets are littered with cases where judgments were made, but under a different name. So that makes it difficult from the Google standpoint to easily find them.
Oh, that's a good point. That's a good point. On the HIPAA side, by the way, those types of things, as Marilyn, as all of us know about, when there's a company that has, you know, far-reaching and has repetitive behaviors, they knew they had issues and they didn't fix them. On the HIPAA side, there are even more severe penalties, you know, when that happens. And I think a lot of that's probably going to fall into this category as we go on and as they develop more and more information on the DOL and EBSA side. But I would think that they're probably going to take a look at some of the HIPAA stuff related to that as well, because you're right, Ted, there can be some situations where name changes, ownership changes, things like that. But you probably know about those things anyway at some point. There's probably some of their literature talking about the fact that there was a sale made or something like that. So again, you might have to take a couple extra steps, but I think that's all really good information.
But when HIPAA first came out, I remember reading a newspaper article that one of the big pension funds hired someone, a new employee who was out on bail for criminal fraud.
And really the DOL is saying that you cannot just take someone's word for it, you know, a company's word for it. You can't just say, I trust, you know, we trust his partner. It's really that fiduciary responsibility says you need to do due diligence to see and define, is this really the right decision you're making on behalf of all your employees? Because these are long-term implications, you know, having someone's retirement plan, having someone's, you know, healthcare benefits and so on. These are long-term implications. And there's also the fact that you're dealing with everybody's personal protected health information and private information. It has long arms. When you have a security breach, the impact of that can go on, you know, for decades in terms of your credit history, your retirement plan getting wiped out, you know. So these are big things. And really what we're trying to do is establish long-term healthy relationships between the company and the service providers. And, you know, and so trust in the beginning, there's a formality that says, show me that this is who you are. Show me this is how you behave. Show me that this is how you protect information. Similarly, in HIPAA, you get your service provider to sign a business associate agreement that says they know HIPAA, they know the rules, and they will abide by the rules.
Yeah, and as I said in my article in the spring, and as I said, as we talked about in our webinar in June, trust but verify, right? Trust mm-hmm. but verify. Okay, so how important are insurance policies related to cybersecurity practices, and what do you have to do to even qualify for it?
Well, I think whether or not your service providers or the employer itself are covered by a cybersecurity policy is important. For the employer itself, it's a business decision for them to make. For a service provider, it's one of those things you fit into the checklist. How much protection are they going to be able to offer you if a breach occurs? And by the way, I would also add, with the service providers, you want to read the indemnification provisions and the limitation of liability provisions in conjunction with the provisions as to what kind of insurance policies they have in place and what level of protection will those insurance policies provide to you. I think the best advice, though, I can give with regard to cybersecurity practice policies is to find a good broker who can help you work through the details, because these policies are in flux, the premiums are in flux, and you want to get cutting edge advice on what's going on, what's available, what is most cost effective as well as most useful for you and your organization, depending on how much data you have and how your systems are structured.
To mirror Marilyn's point, insurance companies are increasingly taking a more sophisticated approach to covering cybersecurity claims. Estimates for the cybersecurity market in 2021 was almost $10 billion. Their estimates for 2027 reach about $30 billion. Premium pricing has doubled 2021 to 2022, and I'm sure we'll see similar increases in 2023 and 2024. Most of these losses absorbed by the insurance companies have caused them to insist on, at minimum, a survey prior to writing policy. And the survey is basically a risk assessment. Some are more comprehensive than others, but that's what, you know, before the company was just insurance companies almost took it as you want a cybersecurity? Well, we'll write a rider for your current policy. Well, they've suffered so many losses in the last couple of years that they're starting to perk their ears up and take steps to make sure that their risk is mitigated prior to writing that policy.
Yeah, it's similar to other, for example, real estate insurance, whether it's in a hurricane zone or an earthquake zone. You know, you've got fewer and fewer providers that want to offer coverage because there's so much risk there. In the cybersecurity and insurance world, there is some, you know, that $10 billion moving to a $30 billion kind of dollar point that we're talking about. And then the ever increasing number of cybersecurity hacks, these companies really have to kind of make some requirements and scrutinize. And they've really started, you know, for the most part, with in a very basic way, very general way. It's kind of similar to these practices, the best practices that are defined here by the DOL. You know, these are really the basics. We're not talking about, you know, super detailed in most cases for the insurance questionnaires and surveys, but they're talking about the basics. And, you know, are you implementing any kind of security practices? Do you use encryption? Do you use strong passwords? Do you use multi-factor authentication? You know, it's some of our favorite security topics for Ted and myself. You know, do you have data backups? Do you test your data backups? And that type of thing. And so they're not super detailed for the most part. Expect them to become more and more detailed over time. And certainly the more insurance coverage that you're looking for and the more that your company has risk surface, lots of employees, lots of different IT systems, you know, handling very sensitive data, you've got a bigger risk surface, they've got more exposure by covering you, you know, et cetera. So look into the future to have the requirements just be increasingly more stringent, or you're going to say, look, we're not going to cover you, or we're going to make your coverage extremely expensive, too expensive maybe for you to get.
Absolutely. Marilyn, how important are contract terms for service providers? In brief, you know, to get us started on this discussion, what types of provisions should be included in service provider agreements?
Well, contract terms are always important, and I'll emphasize to begin with, never simply sign a contract presented to you by a service provider. Read it, understand it, ask questions about it, mark it up, and make certain that it really does have the provisions and the protections that you need to move forward with a strong partnership with this service provider. As Ted said, these are going to be long-term relationships, and you want to make certain that you're comfortable with the terms and conditions under which they'll proceed. With regard to cybersecurity, note whether or not the agreement has any provisions in it which might limit their responsibility in the event of a security breach. Also look at provisions that talk about in the event of a breach, what are their responsibilities for working with you to get it resolved. And keep in mind, you're talking about not only the costs of the breach itself, for example, if money is stolen, for example, but you also want to talk about the cost of sending out notices if you have to send out notifications to your participants as to a security breach. So you want to think about those. Apart from that, I'm going to refer to the tips that the Department of Labor provided. You're going to want to address the ability of you to be able to come in and audit the service provider on a periodic basis, maybe once a year, maybe once every 6 months, whatever is appropriate under the circumstances. You want to make certain that there are limitations on how they can use and disclose the data that they are gathering from you, whether or not they can share it and under what circumstances. They put up firewalls to prevent its use and sharing with certain members of their team or certain other entities. And so forth. You want to understand whether or not they're going to be using subcontractors. And if they are using subcontractors, what protections are built in there, what kind of notice they will provide you of cybersecurity breaches. There's a provision in HIPAA about that, but you also want it to apply more broadly to other types of cybersecurity breaches that might apply in circumstances where HIPAA does not. You want to make certain that they have good record retention practices so that things can be traced as necessary. And then if they do have a cybersecurity policy and that's important to you, make certain that it is designed to cover any breaches or other incidents where you need that protection.
Well, unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. We will continue this right where we left off next week in part two of this very important podcast series. If you'd like to reach out to any of my guests today, you can do so at Marilyn@monahanlawoffice.com. Ted.Flitner@AdidiGroup.com and Ted.Mayashiba@AdidiGroup.com. If you're not sure of the spelling, you can see our show notes for this episode. To everyone out there, please stay safe, stay healthy, and stay tuned for the next episode of the Benefits Executive Roundtable. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for compliance tips, cost containment ideas, new trends, and decision-making tools. This podcast is produced by Advanced Benefit Consulting, Anaheim, California. All views expressed are those of the host or interviewees and not necessarily those of Advanced Benefit Consulting. Information contained herein should not be construed as legal advice. We always recommend that you consult with your legal counsel as situations do vary. Ms. Koshu can be reached at 714-693-9754 extension 3. Toll free at 866-658-3835. Or visit our website at advancedbenefitconsulting.com.